Welcome to the Influential Women Podcast, the podcast where we chat to inspiring women. This is Nikki Bannerman, and my influential woman today is Elisa Kennedy Jones, also known as the blogger Gotham Girl. Hi, Elisa.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me.
Pleasure. It's great to talk to you. Thanks for chatting to me online today from over in America in LA. We're getting really exotic doing these across the pond. Isn't that great that we can do that?
It is indeed.
I'd much rather be in LA, but there we go. Another time.
Yes. Come for the TV show.
Oh, my goodness. I'd love to. Thank you. Now, Elisa is an American memoirist, a blogger, the novelist of Gotham Girl Interrupted, and a public speaker. She's also a regular contributor to National Public Radio NPR, and her blog, Gotham Girl, has around 50,000 followers. So you are a writer for page, stage and screen, writing for TV and theatre, and now for Hollywood. How exciting is that?
Yeah, I'm writing for film and TV, and it is exciting. It's actually something I started out in years ago, so it's nice to come back to it.
Oh my goodness, yes. Are you allowed to say anything you're working on or not?
I'm working on the adaptation of Gotham Girl Interrupted for a half-hour TV series. It's a comedy, and it's fun. It's hard. It's what do I want to say about it? It's going to be an interesting adventure. It was hard enough to get a book made about epilepsy. I think even having a book with the title epilepsy in the title is challenging. So we're looking at different titles for the show in and of itself, but right now it's tentatively titled Spaz, and it will be covering a lot of the material that's actually in the book. Yeah, the misadventure.
Wow, good for you. And you're casting it yourself, are you?
I'm show running it, and I will be part of the casting. You never get to make these decisions by yourself.
Wow, how exciting. That's fantastic. Now, you've told us what you're involved in. I mean, that's the La La Land dream, isn't it? You moved from New York to LA, and that was for your writing work then, was it?
Oh, I haven't moved here entirely. I'm still back and forth between New York and Los Angeles. I went on an extended book tour, which I learned a great deal on, and have just come from Sacramento, California, which is one of the nicest, most Midwestern places you could possibly ever go in California. They're constantly rushing at you with pie and baked goods, and there's no swearing, and it's all very nice. I'm still back and forth between Los Angeles and New York. It looks as though we'll be shooting the show in New York. And I'm excited to be back in the streets working on this kind of stuff. Working on another show that also touches on neurodiversity and epilepsy. And that one I can't fully announce, but I'm super excited for it.
Well, you're really living the dream. It's incredible. So you've written a lot about criminals and strong women. Where does that come from then?
Where does it come from? I grew up in Northern California, which is a wonderful place to grow up in that it has so many criminals. It is this kind of out of the way place, essentially, where my parents moved us to, that is a place where you go if you want to hide or want to not be found or want to get lost. In fact, the title of the local paper is called the Lost Coast Outpost, and it's very much a place where you have a lot of petty, strange criminals who have way too much time on their hands, and there's also a lot of town lore, and that's just something that I've grown up with thinking about, and in terms of the different strange turns that my stories could take, and the strange turn that my story just took a few years ago. But I think it comes from, it's like bread and bone in a way in growing up there.
Wow, gosh, what a life you're leading.
It's got a Twin Peaks kind of vibe.
Now, can we talk more about your book? You've got a copy there. Obviously, we won't be able to show the video because this is audio, but show us a copy of your book and describe that there. Gotham Girl Interrupted: Misadventures in Motherhood, Love, and Epilepsy, which recently came out at the end of last year. Isn't that beautiful title? Purple. And I like the you there holding your handbag. So do you want to just describe that?
So I wrote this book based on a TED talk that I gave several years ago. And I'd started thinking about it because I'd been recently diagnosed at the age of 40 with epilepsy, and it came as a complete shock to me. I'd been on my way to living my best life and doing all the things that Oprah says you're supposed to do and eating clean and green things and all of that. And I ended up having a massive grand mal seizure on my kitchen floor. And it came just sort of as I was on my way to the TV Academy to go to an event. And I really didn't know what, I'd never had any kind of health issue. I was going to yoga. I was with the Yoga Beckies and trying to do the right thing. And I mean, to a certain extent, our brains make other plans and they're wired so uniquely. And it became apparent to me after my diagnosis, because it takes some time to be diagnosed with epilepsy. It's a matter of ongoing seizures and them being unprovoked and having an EEG and really sitting down with the neurologist. But I mean, for that first seizure, it was such an extraordinary kind of experience, in that the first portion of it was like being trapped in a Van Gogh painting. It was just the most beautiful thing that I had ever seen. It was the light show of, like, if you can imagine seeing all the light that across time in one, moment. It was like swallowing the sun. It was incredibly ecstatic and beautiful, which I know is problematic because a lot of people, there are 40 different types of seizures, and 65 million people around the world deal with epilepsy and deal with seizures. And so mine is, everyone is different. Mine happened to be this incredible light show that made me, and I woke up, of course, looking like a prize fighter with a, black eyes and a cut lip and all that. And I totally traumatized my children. Because, they're just not used to seeing their mother dying on the kitchen floor. But I was floored by the diagnosis, but I was also curious. And of course, I did a lot of dangerous Googling, which one should never do, and was struck by a couple of things. And one is that there were so many narratives, so many tragic narratives of people trying to deal with epilepsy, having to really power down their lives in significant ways and stopping working. And suddenly, when I was diagnosed, it was like, okay, no driving, no swimming, no cooking, no nothing. And it was just like, how do you live? How do I do this? And I was kind of, I just, I was defiant in a way. About it, I was like, no, I refuse, and I refuse to give in to the negative narrative, and I wanted to figure out a way to talk. I wanted to figure out how to talk about it in a way that didn't make a misery memoir. I wanted to talk about the parts of it that could be interesting, that could be compelling, that could be even funny. And for me, the funny parts came and sort of waking up to my girlfriend in the hospital after that first seizure. And she's this glamorous sort of Auntie Mame, Emmy Award-winning costume designer. And she, hustles into the hospital, and she's like, out of my way. And she's just like, darling, darling, you've had a seizure. It's the first thing I can hear her velvety voice sort of coming through the blackness. And I was just like, what's a seizure? And then, but also going through the diagnosis and having this ridiculous experience with my EEG guy, who was this gigantic baby of a man. And, you know, I was thinking, okay, I'm just going to keep this light. We're going to keep it light. You know, this is a seizures mean can mean a number of different things. I probably just did too much yoga or something. And I just, you know, taking selfies with him because I looked like the Bride of Frankenstein. I looked like an absolute cyborg with all these wires in my head. And I'm like, here, you know, let's take a shot and that sort of thing. And then the doctor coming in going, huh, does anyone in your family have epilepsy? And very callously telling me, you know, because I'm like, no, absolutely not. No fucking way. And he'll go, because you do. I mean, just very, and it being just shocked. So I wanted to find a way in that moment. I was to discover the narratives, whether they were the ones about Dostoevsky, whether they were the positive stories about different epileptics throughout history, whether it was Isaac Newton or Agatha Christie or Albert Einstein. There were so many really brilliant thinkers and innovators and artists who were grappling with this condition. And so I wanted to find a way to come at this condition through a variety of lenses, one being the artistic lens and the historical lens, and another being the comedic lens, because I think it's so critically important when you're dealing with a chronic condition to be able to have a laugh. It's so important.
Gosh, I mean, the way you describe it, it's beautiful and it's comic and it's personal and it really humanizes something that will help a lot of people, and the way you describe your book like that. And I enjoyed actually reading it and found it funny. I love the way you write and the way you're describing that. I think you should be in your own TV show. Now,
well, I wrote it like a TV show with a cold open in the
exactly.
middle. Like, because who knew? Why does everything have to happen in the grocery store? I mean, who knew I would wake up to this Milo Ventimiglia type character, this gorgeous EMT. If I wasn't having a seizure, I'd be certainly like shooting my eggs at him or something because I was just like, this is, wow.
Yes. I think that only happens in LA, that all doctors, or in New York, that all doctors are divine.
Oh my gosh, that's so handsome.
That's and what's so, meant to happen. Yeah. Oh my goodness. But you do have perspective, wit and humility. I mean, you wrote in a very warm, funny and honest way about being a person who has seizures and facing, you know, massive health obstacles. Now, the name Gotham describes being in New York City, obviously Gotham City, where Batman often was. Were you thinking that you were the girl equivalent who could tackle anything?
No, when I first started writing Gotham Girl, I had no such pretensions. I had no. When I first started writing Gotham Girl, it was more about writing a love letter to New York City, because it is a city with tremendous conflict and tremendous dirt and tremendous neurodiversity all around. I mean, you will a walk down my block to my neurologist I will encounter easily many blind people. People with autism, people who are living their best deaf lives and who are hearing impaired. And, you know, it is a very neurodiverse city, and it is a very, it's very much a city of conflict, but at the same time that breeds a unique type of intimacy because people are constantly telling you what they think.
But that's what we love.
So that's where Gotham Girl was more about my walking around New York City and in awe and in being still in love with the city after having come back there after a number of years out on the West Coast.
Oh, lovely and great title. Now, you at one point described in your book an experiment that understandably you didn't want to lose money in hospital for 3 days not working. But with your condition, you couldn't drive, as you said, so you had to get on the bus all wired up. I mean, that must have been incredibly sort of difficult.
It was and it wasn't. It was shocking to me how kind people were. That experiment in empathy really is what was happening on that bus that day. I looked like, I just to paint the picture, I was wired with an ambulatory a walk around EEG, so I had all these wires stuck into my head and taped. And the way they tape you up in this bright white surgical tape is just ridiculous. You look like a walking tampon. You just look completely, or cotton swab or something. You just are wrong. And so it's not like a person without hair who might be going through cancer or some kind of illness that puts you, you know, has you lose your hair, because you really are quite misshapen. And so I was on the bus and noticing people noticing my wires and my pack, because you wear this pack sort of on your front, almost like a messenger bag, but it's a slightly smaller. But I covered it with a scarf. I got out my best scarf, but I guess what I was shocked by was the amount of empathy and sympathy and curiosity that people had in just asking me questions about epilepsy and asking me, you know, and, you know, trying to make a seat available, because you are carrying quite a bit when you're marching around and going into the office with this cyborg unit on my person. I thought, this is my chance to see how to test the bounds of discomfort with people wanting to know and not wanting to know, and where will and what questions will they ask, and what will that tell me about them? Yes. And it reveals quite a bit about people when they start to ask you questions. But I was most surprised and shocked by the other parents at school.
And they were kind to you, weren't they? They were kind to you, as were the children. You know, it was brave. It was brave.
Yeah, well, I mean, and why wouldn't they be kind? I mean, but they had also just seen me looking, you know, la, 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 perfectly ordinary the day before. And they were asking lots of questions, but they were also just, what can we do? Can we help? How do we even respond if you ever had a seizure? And how does Sophie respond, my youngest daughter, you know, when this sort of thing happens? And, you know, you lay out the kinds of basic steps of, yeah, if a person has a seizure, you're going to treat them like you treat anyone having a medical emergency, mostly. You're not going to stick anything in their mouths. That's the main thing to know. But you are going to, you know, stay with them, turn them on their side, and really keep their head safe, because there can be injury in that realm, and that can be a real bummer. But they were just empathetic, sympathetic, and welcoming in ways that I couldn't have even imagined. And we ended up being very close friends for years. In fact, I just saw one of the other moms the day before yesterday, and she has been through this entire epilepsy journey with me. And she's actually a doctor, and I can't get over how open it's possible for people to be. That's why I don't understand negative media portrayals of people having seizures.
Gosh, good for you. You're really sort of taking the positive in it, aren't you? I mean, you had your first seizure, as you said, diagnosed with ecstatic epilepsy when you were 40. I mean, are people diagnosed as children, or there is no sort of normal age? It can happen at any time.
It can happen at any time. Honestly, anyone with a brain can be diagnosed with epilepsy at any given time.
Wow. So
it's not something that's restricted to children. I think it's especially hard in children, and especially if you're dealing with issues of like SUDEP, which is sudden unexplained death and epilepsy. I mean, obviously those are things that are incredibly tragic. But honestly, anyone with a brain injury, anyone dealing with other neurodiversity issues like autism or Asperger's, there's a significant comorbidity. 50% of those with autism or people on the autism spectrum are also dealing with seizures. So it really is anyone, any healthy person. I have another friend who is a triathlete, And he, at age, I want to say he's probably 65, has just been diagnosed.
Wow, gosh, it is. I mean, this is actually really going to help a lot of people and be aware, you know. And you're known by the title Ecstatic Epilepsy, which understandably you are less than ecstatic about, although you do make jokes about it, don't you? And as you say, you know, some very well-known high profile, a lot of creative people, writers and painters like Van Gogh, Da Vinci and Agatha Christie have had this that I'm not sure if we're aware of either.
Yeah, it was surprising to me when I dug into the research on the, because again, I found those two things. I found a lot of really bummer narratives of like, oh, you won't go to college. Oh, you won't be able to keep a job with epilepsy. Oh, you won't do this and you'll miss out on life. And then I also found, oh, you'll do all these things. And so very, very much like the two ends of the spectrum. And so for the TED Talk, it was important, I think, to show that there were all these amazing people and that we're all wired so very differently. And we need to make room for each other and for that difference in wiring.
Definitely, definitely. And you can do all those things now, cook and...
Oh, yeah. I cook like crazy. I cook. I'm big on pie. I'm quite the pie enthusiast.
Oh, so, yeah. And why not? Wow, we need to put a recipe on here as well. Now, the seizures you described.
Oh, I should do that on the website, actually, because I've got that cherry bourbon pie that I was making to get my language back.
Oh, yummy. You should definitely do that. And we all need to see that. Now, the seizures you described left you feeling terrified yet invigorated. And the big grand mal seizure you mentioned, you said was equivalent to swallowing a bolt of lightning and has another... I mean, that's scary in itself, but you had a story about being struck by lightning as a child, and that was nothing to do with it.
Struck by lightning. My parents were hippies, and they were ridiculous, and it was the 70s, and so it was relaxed parenting, I think, free-range parenting, as it were. And I touched an electric fence, and so my first seizure, the after effects of feeling that first seizure kind of brought me back to that moment in time when I was 4 years old. And, you know,
just four.
And I was talking to this horse. My parents were looking at land. They wanted to do this whole back to the land thing. I wasn't so sure about it, but I had no idea. And I just put my finger down on this wire on this fence and I just flew. I was wearing these ridiculous shoes that we all wore in the 70s. I think they're called Buster Browns or something like that. But they look like you're wearing giant meatballs on your feet. But they just, one of them just flew right off and into the dirt. And I'm lying there in the mud. And my parents were just like, what is going on? What
if... They didn't realize you'd been electrocuted.
Yeah, and it had, and my seizures later had nothing to do with the fact that, you know, I probably, yeah, touched the, it was, it was probably a very low current, but, and they have nothing to do with that incident. But I do remember a kind of having this electric kind of new beginning, beginner's mind feeling after each seizure. I think what happens, it's like you, when you're arousing, when you're waking a person up who's had a significant seizure, like a tonic-clonic grand mal on the ground convulsive seizure, you know, they're probably going to be a little, they're going to be confused and afraid and sort of very kind of terrified. So it's a matter of like you staying calm and being a hero in the moment of like, it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. You're here. You're you. You're you. And, you know, I have funny moments, I mean, horrible moments, because I do get the same voice every time I wake up from a seizure of this, usually the person who's waking up going, Alisa, can you tell me who the president is? And it's like, no, but, not that again. So I have a moment of that. But mostly everything is in Technicolor and the world feels new and fresh.
Gosh. So, I mean, you make it, obviously some of it sound good, but it's not good for everybody.
No, it isn't, because I did break my face in 16 places in 2015.
My word.
And if you can see here, I have no motion because my facial nerves were severed. So I only have one side. They took my entire face off, put in a prosthetic jaw here, and then rebuilt this side here.
Well, you look very good.
And I still had metal pins and metal pins here, but I had plates and pins in my face and I was wired shut for about a year.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness. Well, let's hope.
So no, epilepsy is not for...
not to be taken in by the lighthearted. My goodness, you are really incredible. I can't believe
it. And when you can't talk in New York, all you can do is write. So all I did was write a book.
Fantastic.
I was, wired shut on the subway, and it was ridiculous most of the time.
Horrible, horrible feeling. So I've read that this rare form that you have during the seizure, the auras actually provoke feelings of well-being, intense serenity, bliss, and enhanced self-awareness, which almost feels like divine calm. Is that right?
It does feel like divine calm. And that's what's weird, is you shouldn't like something that is so destructive and so can be so harmful. But that's what's hard to negotiate about this particular brand of epilepsy. And I mean, I definitely grieve. I still grieve from my life before epilepsy. I would rather be that healthy girl who can smile, because now I can only smirk.
Oh, bless you. But you're making so much the best of it, and pioneering and leading frontiers, aren't you, with what you are doing?
With traumatic brain injury that we see from veterans, people are having those types of seizures. There's so much work to be done in the space of the brain. I think that's my overarching lesson of this adventure, is that, man, you think the brain is weird with 100 billion cells, but it's actually weirder than you can think.
Incredible. Definitely. I mean, just reading, some of your book and reading online about it, it's literally an eye-opener. Now, you mentioned the Russian writer, and I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing this right, Dostoevsky?
Dostoevsky.
Dostoevsky. Now, the Russian writer Dostoevsky that you referred to in your book, Gotham Girl Interrupted, described it, the type of seizure that you have, as a happiness unthinkable in the normal state and unimaginable for anyone who hasn't experienced it. He said he was in perfect harmony with himself and the entire universe. And indeed, in his novel, his character said, "I would give my whole life for this one instant." And at the start of his epileptic fit, he was overflowing with unbounded joy and rapture, ecstatic devotion, and completest life. I mean, he's describing it in a beautiful way too.
He is, but it's not that way for everyone. I think it can be challenging. It has been every seizure that I've had is different. There's some that are more starry, and others that are more that velvety blackness that is very serene and incredibly peaceful. And what's hard is waking up and coming back and back to life and crawling back to life, because there are those, and I don't mean to dwell on the negative, but there are these ridiculous moments where you've woken up from a seizure and your words are off kilter. You go to say the word garage, and instead yard comes out and garbage comes out, and then finally garage comes out. You go to say the word sink, and nothing comes out. So you end up saying that thing that we put the dishes in before we put them in the dishwasher, and your kids are looking at you like, a sink? You mean the sink? And you're looking at them going,
I don't think that's a word. And so I got to look that up. There are all these pieces of coming back, I think, after the seizure that are so not peaceful. So Dostoevsky's like, I would trade my entire life. No, I would not trade my entire life for that blissful moment.
And to be back how you were. And obviously it's very frightening for a lot of people, and we need to understand that, and this will help them. Now, you believe it's the brain with too much electricity going through it.
I would say that it's, I don't believe it. I mean, atypical levels of electricity. I've had girlfriends who were trying to talk me down from being diagnosed during the diagnosis of thinking, oh, this is the end of the world. To say, well, maybe you're just a little overly electric. Maybe you could try to reframe it and see it that way. And I thought that was a helpful way of looking at it. But typically, I mean, the clinical definition without being clinical is that sort of atypical levels of electricity operating in different areas of the brain. And there are different types of seizures that start in different areas of the brain that don't have an ecstatic aura, and that don't give people warning. And so that's why it's important to kind of know what to do.
Definitely. And knowing what to do, it's a myth to put a spoon in someone's mouth now, then, is it? It's something you definitely shouldn't do.
Yeah, I mean, you're more likely to lose a finger or something. I mean, you really don't want to put anything in anyone's mouth. It can cause all kinds of jaw dislocation, or they could choke, or again, you could be injured. It's just important. It's sort of three S's, is that you stay with the person, don't leave them on their own, keep onlookers away, and you turn them on their side in case the person aspirates, because that can easily happen in a seizure scenario. And you time the seizure, so you stay with them. So that, again, that third S, you time it. Generally speaking, if you're looking at a seizure that's lasting over 5 minutes, you're gonna wanna call 999 or 911 in the States. Because you could be looking at multiple seizures happening one after the other, or if there's any kind of injury, if they've actually conked their head, or I've conked my head, please, you know, call. I think the tricky thing that a lot of epileptics that I've met during the book tour, and this is now my 14th city that I've been in for this tour, is that at least in the States, it can be very catastrophic financially if people are having multiple seizures and the ambulance is called every time. You're looking at $3,000 to $5,000 in a bill, and so it's something that, you know, I always have said, when we put together my little seizure response plan for our household, that I like to recover at home. I know exactly what I need. I've got my little playlist. I've got, you know, the things that make me feel better. And if I'm not injured, it's the place that I prefer to stay. So that seizure response plan, and that sort of thing that we all kind of carry around in our purses of, here's what you do if I'm having a seizure, is something that also enables people to be empowered in the moment. If you're out in public, or say you're on a train or you're on a plane.
Well, very helpful, and helpful for a lot of people now. Now, you've mentioned that it's the fourth most common neurological condition and affects 65 million people. I mean, that is a phenomenal amount, and terrifying, as you say. Now, and you are a mother, a single mother, as am I, and faced a similar feral divorce, which you are so warmly and accurately described in your book as a blood sport of self-recrimination, indictment, and 2 years of hell. And we need to do a podcast on that very subject.
Oh my gosh. Oh, divorce is the worst. It's like waking up and being in a car accident every day for 2 years. It's terrible. And
it's something to be avoided.
I own my share of the problem, but I would not, it's not a path I would choose.
No, or recommend anyone to do that. So that's probably kept some people on the on their path. Now, in life, you do find the funny in life's dark but inevitable challenges, as do I. I try to do that too, and it helps being a writer, doesn't it? But your career was previously working in digital advertising, branding and strategy for some big clients. Coca-Cola, Tommy Hilfiger, Disney, Colgate. Do you still do that, or it's full-time writing?
At this point, I am writing full-time for TV primarily. I just finished a movie also that I'm actually quite excited about. It was quite lovely to work on. So I haven't worked for in the client space for branding and advertising in since 2015, really. I have done some consulting with a couple of firms, but writing has taken up so much of my brain and so much of my time that it hasn't been a moment for it. I mean, I have to say.
And successful writing, you know, and writing that's actually doing something to help everyone else and yourself.
Yeah, and I did get to, I mean, I've been fortunate enough in my previous career in branding and advertising to get to work with some amazing clients who taught me how to work through a process and methodology and to get to a distilled, concise, emotional win of an idea. So I really learned how to write through advertising and through working in the ad world. And the digital space. I didn't set out, I never thought that I would write a memoir ever. I thought I might write some ridiculous scripts, and I've definitely written my share of commercials, and most of them are just awful, but just horrible. I would say I was pretty much a kind of a mediocre marketing girl, but I still learned a great deal from the trade and having to be in the room with a group of people from very different disciplines working across on a project that, you know, had a lot of multiple interdependencies and where everyone had to be very collaborative. And there was a lot of improv inadvertently required of that kind of work. And I enjoyed it very much. I mean, I love the writer's room. So any time that I can be with other writers figuring stuff out, it's the most fun I've ever had in my life.
And oh, wow.
EA, Electronic Arts, and Disney afforded those opportunities, and GE afforded those opportunities for me. So I'm completely grateful.
Fantastic, fantastic. Now, which strong women or men have inspired you then?
Where to begin? It's almost too hard. There are so many women right now who are doing an amazing job, whether it's AOC here in the States, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who's speaking out in ways that you haven't heard from our government in so long. But growing up, I mean, I took a lot of... I was influenced by Emerson, Thoreau, but also... the scrappy women in my life and growing up with the scrappy friends and friends of our family and friends of my mother and father and just who were unafraid to take on the other side or grab on to a debate and go for it and who were always persistently and consistently learning and curious and had a kind of fever for it. And hunger for it. So there were a lot of people in my life who were very close, like Joy Kimple is a woman who was very close in my growing up years. And she was a chef and also a nurse and an amazing person. She was a neurology nurse. So she unfortunately passed away from the glioblastoma, the brain cancer, the same brain cancer that... took John McCain, and it's a very aggressive type of brain cancer. But I've had these kinds of women sort of down and dirty in my life since the very beginning. I think she threw me a birthday party on my 18th birthday. It was a Sagittarius party. And so she invited Sagittarians that she'd known
her entire life to have a dinner party. And they were all different ages. So she was like, I want you to, whether you believe it or not, I want you to take a look at this through this lens at all the crazy Sagittarian women that I know in life. And we're going to read cards and they're going to tell you that, you know, their life lessons so that you can be prepared in life.
Oh, she sounds wonderful and influential. What a shame she's not around to interview her.
She was great. She and her daughters are amazing, and the whole family was amazing. But this was a person who, so then you would get a nurse who had just come from Kenya working with, in a terrible type of relief organization, not a terrible relief organization, a great relief organization, but a
challenging.
Yeah. Yes, I'm doing, really important work around the country, but then also another writer, a psychologist, and she had this whole
interesting people. Fantastic. So can we talk about your passions? What are your hobbies? How do you relax and spend your time off? Because you were passionate about hot yoga and you did do swimming, but presumably it's tough that you can't do some of those anymore.
My passions. I would say I'm still passionately addicted to cooking. And that comes from growing up in a kind of farm-to-table environment. And so I do spend a lot of time, and I will probably spend a good 2 hours cooking tonight, something. Any kind of chopping. I'm like, any kind of chopping is passionate. It isn't. It's the act of cooking and cooking with people that I actually really love. And so I've held on to that. And that also does provide a kind of safety in the event that I were to feel like I was going to have a seizure, is that I'm constantly cooking with my girlfriends and with family.
Oh, lovely.
So, yeah. And I have stayed, I'm definitely passionate about our show. It's called New Hope. And it is a show that I've been working on for some time with my writing partner from Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Wow. And
so that's been going forward. And so being in the room, I would say like that work, that is a love project. And that is the kind of thing that I won't give up. And I wouldn't trade the way that I think about that kind of material for a better brain. I think that I definitely am like, what's the most radical thing I can do here is like my brain the way it is. And I get to do that in the writer's room. And so I am impassioned about that. I do still go to yoga and Pilates. I just don't do the hot kind. And I really try to listen in to, you know, how I'm doing. There are good days and bad days when it comes to the types of medications that you end up taking with this condition. And some days you're going to feel more energetic and other days you're not, and you're going to have to be okay with that.
So do you have a mantra for living your life then?
Find the deep pockets of joy between each seizure. It's so short. And if I can suck the joy out of life in the same and bring the same kind of bliss that I've felt in certain seizure scenarios to the actual life that I'm living, that's something that matters to me, and I feel like it's going to make life better. Also, I think I want to, another mantra would be, fight for your brain. Fight to keep it healthy. Fight to have more interventions and better health care so that we can solve this puzzle, because it's a complex puzzle and we really need to understand the brain so much more than, brain health has become front and center for me.
Definitely. And I think that'll ring true to a lot of people, and hearing your story, in motivating them to help you and others. Now, one of the quotes in your book, was it Max Planck who said, when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change? I really liked that.
Yes, the physicist. He's so smart and he's often quoted by a lot of self-help people, I guess, but I don't read a lot of self-help. I read novels, and that's another one, Jane Austen.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Fabulous.
Jane Austen, Emily Dickinson, Edna St. Vincent Millay. Here are my strong women.
Oh, there you are. There they all are. Yeah, they are strong.
Virginia Woolf, except, you know, at the end. Oh, terrible. But, I mean, just such incredible writers and thinkers. And now, back to the question.
It was about the mantra. And your lovely thoughts, they're similar to a mantra, was about not being weighted down by certainty to bring hope and possibilities. Do you want to just explain that? I don't want to change part of your book and give it away. But you had mentioned don't let certainty change.
Oh, make you small. Yeah. Yes, it's very easy, I think, to... And I know this so in my bones and in my heart. We're all so desperate for certainty and a clear plan and moments of clarity and knowing what to do. And I've grown up with a mother who always was like, okay, so this is a disaster. Here's what we're going to do. And she always had a plan. She always knew exactly. She was so resourceful. She's like, we're going to start here. We're going to do this. And then we're going to try this, and this is probably going to go wrong, but then we're going to go do that. So, like, that certainty was always very comforting to me. And what I've had to get comfortable with over the past 9 years that I've been dealing with epilepsy is getting comfortable with uncertainty and all the anxiety that can creep in with that and depression even because it's a lot. And I think we are in a kind of epileptic age in a way. We're all grappling with being bombarded with messaging and so much uncertainty around the messaging, no matter where you live, of like what feels true to you. And it's a constant reassessment, and we're constantly correcting what we thought we knew. But it's like, how can you get in the flow of that uncertainty so that you can be responsive in the moment to it? So if I am feeling seizure-y, as I call it, and I'm uncertain that I'm going to have a seizure that day, I'm responding to it. I'm telling people. I werewolf myself. I'm like, I'm going to cocoon today because I know that I need this time and space, and I don't want to risk having a seizure because that can feel like it can be so disruptive and so traumatizing to people around me as well. That I, you know, I want to try to take care and be proactive. But again, that comes with like, I'm going to have to get comfortable with the uncertainty that I could just be walking down the street or down the coffee aisle in the grocery store and have another seizure. And that's what's happening. And I better make sure or do my best to equip the people around me to respond in a way that lets me stay alive and lets them feel better about what they know, about what they're doing in the moment.
Yeah, amazing. Amazing. And I think, you know, you're leading the way very differently to how a lot of people would cope with that. And that's brilliant. I admire you. Now, what's your next goal then? It sounds like you've got so many goals and so many things happening and so much writing that you don't need any more goals. This is your goal, the TV show.
My next goal is to finish the TV adaptation of Spaz and to get it to my producer so that he can go ha 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 and be delightful. And he can say, we can totally work this because I would love to see a mainstream voice around epilepsy and neurodiversity in our media and in our content and in a way that's not a misery memoir or typical sick lit, as I call it. So my next goal is to finish the adaptation. And yes, there are a number of projects in the hopper. I think you have to keep it that way because otherwise, I mean, I don't work any other way,
So it's just one after like, oh, we should really write this. And so I did just finish a ridiculous movie about Christmas movie about pie that I absolutely love. And it has a song and dance number in it. And I would love, I mean, hopefully it makes it to all the way, but.
Definitely will. And you've taught us some lingo and, you know, sick lit instead of chick lit and scrappy and hopper and things, you know, that are just enlightening to all of us. No, not at all. It's fabulous. No, I'm going to use them.
Oh my gosh, please do. No, I have so many. I mean, I always have at least three projects in the hopper, as I say. So I have Gotham Girl as the TV show. I'm also collecting old Gotham Girl essays that about New York City into an anthology, because there are some about New Yorkers that just show the scrappiness. They show the persona. They show the city at, I think, its greatest. And New York is struggling on any given day, but it also is a place of artists and writers and thinkers and people. It gave me an incredible gift in that I was able to get well in a city where everyone's a weirdo. And I was allowed to be just exactly as I am, whereas LA is a little, you know, more, you know, it's just different. Everyone's pretty here. But... yeah, so Gotham Girl Interrupted as a TV show. I think I'd be very glad for that. And then New Hope is another television show dealing with autism. And we're hoping for a third project dealing with Alzheimer's.
Wow, really? Gosh, I think you're doing amazingly. And these are all really inspiring and going to inspire so many people. We're so looking forward to hearing more about them.
Well, when I can make the formal announcement, I'll email you.
Yes, please do. But we've teased the listeners now. And this is our first international online podcast interview, you know. Lastly, what key message would you give to influence women or men out there? I mean, I think they've been hugely inspired by everything you've said, but have you got any last message for them?
Don't be afraid to be exactly who you are. Unfiltered can be great. Sometimes our brains are, you know, they play tricks on us, and I look at it, any chronic condition. I would say my message to people dealing, and there are so many people dealing with chronic conditions, everybody's got something in their lives, whether it's arthritis or whether it's anxiety or whether it's me with epilepsy. I think it can be part of your juiciness. So I would say lean into it and see what happens, because it might just surprise you.
Oh, that's fabulous. And what I loved was your honesty about things people don't talk about, you know, and we're bringing out the American side of that. You know, you're very good at talking openly, and where you said epilepsy teaches you that life is about battling to discover who you are supposed to be and to find your tribe, no matter how much flopping around on the ground and wetting yourself you have to do together.
I've done a lot of flopping. Not as much wedding, just so you know, to be perfectly honest. But I mean, it's a thing that happens. But yes, we're constantly, I do feel like we're driven out into the world to kind of bear witness to and tell our stories in certain ways. And just when you think you've gotten to what your story should be, something comes along and nudges you to tell, to become something else. And it, that is, in a way, that's how improv and comedic improv has helped me to cope with some of these things. I think being able to say yes and being able to find the agreement in the room or with my brain in my head, because it's not an easy thing. I think when you're suddenly negotiating a lifetime of medications, a lifetime of changes, and suddenly you have to feel like you don't want to be a burden to anyone, but there are going to be times when you're going to have to ask for help, where you may have been the most self-reliant, and that goes back to Emerson and self-reliance and all of that, and growing up with strong women and suddenly being vulnerable was a big shift for me.
Definitely. And I think you've handled it so amazingly and inspired so many people.
I'm trying really hard to just not screw up the science too much. So just know that the next edition will probably have updates on like the clinical stuff, because we're learning so much. about the brain. Every month there's something new that comes out that is a new bit of science. And science isn't quite working fast enough for me, but I'm kind of an impatient New Yorker, so...
But you're helping lead everyone along the way. And I
I'm like, hurry up. Hurry up, science. Hurry up right now.
I really hope it does, because I think you're coping amazingly. And I hope science rewards you. And thank you for your time.
Thank you so much for having me. And thank you for putting up with my brain.
Your brain is wonderful. You've got a beautiful, wonderful brain there. And we look forward to hearing more about your story. So I'll just do a close. If anyone needs to seek further advice, we'd urge you to speak to your doctor or associated charities to know you are not alone with epilepsy. Thank you so much, Elisa. You are one very influential woman. I'm sure you've helped many people with their life for the better and improve their happiness and endurance with living with epilepsy for the future. So for that, I thank you. The Influential Women's Podcast is presented by Nikki Bannerman and co-produced with Juliet Nichols. Please subscribe for free and keep listening for more podcast guests on our channel on Apple Podcasts, Comcast, Pocket Cast and Spotify. And we'd love a 5-star review on iTunes. We're getting huge interest from advertisers and sponsors, so please contact us through Twitter, LinkedIn or Instagram should you wish to associate or collaborate with us as part of the program and to inspire and influence women and men for future episodes. Contact us at nikkibannermanradio.co.uk or through pineappleaudioproduction.com.